We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. After the attacks of 9/11, people all around America were all asking the same questions. Where had this movement called Al-Qaeda come from? What was their agenda? Who was leading it? Why did they decide to attack the United States? Lawrence Wright, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, spent 5 years looking for answers to these very questions and ended up writing a book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. It was published first in 2006, won many awards, including the Pulitzer Prize, and many people feel that it is one of the best books to be written about the attacks of 9/11. The book explores the backgrounds of the founders of Al-Qaeda, looks at what was known about them before the attack, and makes the argument that if the U.S. intelligence community had taken the threat more seriously, it's possible that the attacks of 9/11 could have been prevented. This morning, in this hour of the show, we're happy to have back with us again as our guest, Lawrence Wright. He's an author, screenwriter, playwright, continues to be a staff writer for The New Yorker, and we'll be talking about 9/11 then, about Al-Qaeda today, and take whatever questions that folks have who are listening. We just hope that people can stay on target for us and try to keep their comments brief. That way we can keep moving along and get in as many callers as possible. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, 333-9455 is the number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We do also have email, will-talk@illinois.edu. So if you'd like to do it that way, you can certainly give us your question or comment in that way. And Mr. Wright, hello.
Thank you, David. It's good to be with you again.
Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us your time. I thought maybe we could start the way I'm sure that you've started so many talks about 9/11 and about Al-Qaeda. I could start by asking you to talk a little bit about the people who make up the organization, who they are, and can you look at them, their background, and say that there are certain things that certain experiences, certain ways of looking at the world that they share in common?
Well, Al-Qaeda, when it began in 1988 in Peshawar, was made up largely of Egyptians. They were led by Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's now the number one man in Al-Qaeda. He was number two then. But he had his own terror organization in Egypt called Al-Jihad. And he brought many of those members to Afghanistan and Pakistan during the jihad against the Soviets. And it was in Peshawar that he encountered this young Saudi, this Osama bin Laden, who had a kind of mystique about him, in part because he was a Saudi. That carries a lot of freight in the Muslim world. That's the holy land of Islam. He was also rich. And you didn't find a lot of rich people going off to fight in the jihad. So from the beginning, he was someone that everyone remarked. And he was, marked as a leader, but also he had money. And that was desperately needed by Zawahiri and others. So he was the golden goose, and they surrounded him. And they brought with them talent. Many of them were army officers or police officers. They were technocrats. Zawahiri himself was a surgeon. And so they gave a kind of ready-made group to Osama bin Laden. Mm. And that was the formation of Al-Qaeda.
And if you look at the background of these people, I think, and certainly a lot has been written about this, they are people who were intelligent, well-educated. They were middle class, some cases upper middle class. Many of them had actually been educated in the West. Many of them were actually not particularly zealous when it came to their faith, their religion. And I guess what strikes me when you make a list like that And then you think about the kind of wave of political change that we have seen really just in its beginnings now in the Arab world, North Africa and the Middle East. People who have risen up against their governments, and we've seen several governments fall. It looks like the same, in many ways, the same kind of people, which makes you wonder what really is the difference between the impulse that goes into al-Qaeda and the impulse that turned people out, say, in Egypt, a place that you know, in Tahrir Square, that was directed in a more peaceful way to, in a sense, the same goal that the al-Qaeda people had, and that was a change of government.
Yeah, it's an interesting comparison. There was a study done in the 1970s about the radical young Muslims that were at that point filling up the prisons in Egypt. And to the surprise of the authors, they found that these were, you know, for the most part, highly educated, intelligent young men. They called them model young Egyptians. And they were technocrats. They were interested in fields of engineering and medicine and science, and yet they were drawn to radical Islam largely, I think, because that seemed to be the only alternative to overthrowing the kind of dictatorial autocratic government that they found themselves in. The whole notion of nonviolent protest was just not a feature of the society at that point. Only armed revolution or coups, which is what Egypt had experienced in the past, were the kinds of alternatives that they thought about. So what we see now with the Arab Spring is a radical paradigm shift in the thinking of many Arabs. They had been playing the government's game, which is violence. And now they played a different game, and the government didn't know how to cope with it. And it's, I think, it's not only changed the governments in many of those Arab countries and many, maybe more to come, but it's also changed the mentality about social revolution.
Yeah. Something that also seems to be striking, at least about what we've seen so far, in terms of these waves of political change that we've seen again in North Africa and the Middle East, is that there does not seem to be an important component of anti-Americanism here. And again, that takes me back to al-Qaeda. The idea that I think people ought to have is that first and foremost, what al-Qaeda was interested in was changing governments in the Arab world. Primarily, but then the question becomes, well, how is it that that energy also gets transferred into a war against the West and against the United States? And then again, why is it that now, with what we're seeing in the region, that seems to be absent?
Well, let's trace the career a little bit of Ayman al-Zawahiri, the man that's ahead of it now. His original goal, he started a cell to overthrow the Egyptian government when he was 15 years old. And just imagine that, the nerve, the vision, that it took for this young man to decide that was his life's mission. He organized groups of students, eventually brought in soldiers and police officers. He was arrested for a peripheral role in the assassination of Anwar Sadat in 1981 and spent 3 years in prison. Those were very, very formative years for him because until that point, he had been essentially interested in a coup, a swift military coup. He was not interested in a vast bloodletting, which is what is so characteristic of al-Qaeda, his appetite for carnage. That's unusual, really, in terrorist organizations. They're principally theatrical in nature. But with al-Qaeda, Zawahiri and others came out of that prison very, very, I think, psychologically deformed. They'd been tortured, and also they spent 3 years in this debating society, wondering what they had done wrong. they had, in the parlance of Islamist discourse, Egypt was the near enemy. That was their goal, was to overthrow the near enemy, the tyrants that rule Egypt, and establish an Islamic theocracy. And they were brutally defeated in that goal. And in prison, they began to debate about maybe there's another way of going about it. The way that they came up with was to attack what they call the far enemy. In other words, mainly the U.S., but the West as well. Because the far enemy is supporting and propping up the near enemy, the Mubarak regime. So the logic that we saw evolve into al-Qaeda came out of those prisons.
Hmm. Well, you can understand then the kind of brutality that was visited on people like Ayman al-Zawahiri and others by their governments. You could see how that would produce in them a desire to strike back in the extreme. How then, though, do you explain someone like Osama bin Laden, who was, you know, the son of a very wealthy construction magnate, a family that was closely associated with the royal family of Saudi Arabia, a man who should have felt that he had great prospects and could have had a very fine life. So what was it that set him on this path?
It's fascinating to consider that contrast because, you know, unlike Zawahiri, you know, bin Laden came from a very distinguished family, you know, a very wealthy family. And he had never been humiliated, never beaten by prison guards. He'd never been locked in a cage with wild dogs, as was the case with Zawahiri. So that kind of humiliation was not a part of his life, and yet he speaks about humiliation all the time, and his speeches are larded with this word, humiliation. And I think it has to do with a sense of humiliation that many Muslims felt by the retreat of their religion for hundreds of years from the prominence it once held. And when I lived in Egypt, that was 1969 to 1971, you know, I this comes to mind because I was speaking there last year before the revolution, and a young woman asked me, "What happened to us? You know, why have we fallen behind?" And I thought about how, in 69, 70, that era, Egypt was about on a par with South Korea, with India, with Indonesia, with China. Countries that have rocketed ahead economically and socially ahead of Egypt. And Egypt and other Arab countries have been mired in this very stagnant backwater. And I told her I thought that it takes a generation. You know, it takes a, you know, and my father's generation, you know, coming out of the Dust Bowl, very poor country. He was not a poor country, but a very poor background. But his generation won World War II and created the greatest economic engine in the world. And there are similar generations doing that kind of work right now in South Asia. One day that generation will arise in the Arab world. And I had no idea when I was making that statement that I was talking to that generation. And I'm convinced that they're the ones that are going to make that transformation.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Lawrence Wright. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and is author of the book The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. It was first published in 2006. It continues to be available. It's now in paperback. It's published by Vintage, won the Pulitzer Prize and a number of other awards. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, just for a moment to continue with the question about what's happened within the countries of North Africa and the Middle East. Is it too much of an overgeneralization to say a big part of the problem here was governments that were mainly concerned with preserving their own power, securing whatever benefits there were to be secured for themselves and their cronies and their supporters, and that what we had just was some extremely ossified regimes there who were not interested in change, and at the tiniest sign of dissent, crushed it brutally.
Yeah, that's certainly a major part of the problem, but you know, it was reflected in so many different ways. The lack of interest in education, for instance, and just to take the example of Cairo, crossing the street, it's dangerous for pedestrians in Cairo. I mean, I cannot overemphasize how hard it is to get across the street. There are no traffic lights, there are no walkways, there's no crossing guards. When I lived in Cairo, I had a servant who kind of came with the job, and he cooked dinner for me, and we became very close friends. He lost two of his children to traffic. It's a very common story, you know, that the indifference that the government displayed by simply not addressing the perils that ordinary people face simply in crossing the street, to me, exemplified the cruelty and the indifference of that kind of government.
Hmm. Well, going back to the story of the formation of Al-Qaeda, I think it's one of the things that's striking is that, at least in a number of places, it seems that chance certainly played a role. You have to look at someone like Ayman al-Zawahiri, who you argue as somebody who maybe had great organizational skills, but definitely was not a charismatic leader, was not a great speaker. This was not the guy who could lead a group like Al-Qaeda. But when he found Osama bin Laden, that was striking gold, because he indeed was very charismatic and did have those qualities. And so it was important for Zawahiri to have somebody like bin Laden for him to stand beside, and or maybe a step or two behind, because he didn't, certainly Zawahiri did not have the leadership qualities that would have been necessary.
I think that, you know, he ran his own organization into the ground, and he may well do that for Al-Qaeda. We can certainly hope so. But I do think that there is a contending figure on the horizon in Anwar al-Awlaki, who is charismatic, and he has advantages that bin Laden didn't have. He is an American citizen. He speaks English fluently. He's hiding in Yemen. But he's been able to get his message out very well. Moreover, he has the religious credentials that bin Laden never had. So I think, you know, we can celebrate the death of Osama bin Laden, and it's right that we do take some solace in his passing. But we do have other figures to face down in the future, and al-Awlaki is the one that's most on my mind.
You know, one of the things that I did was I went back and I looked at a talk that you gave in, I believe it was in 2007, and it was at Google, in their Authors at Google series, where you were there to talk about the book. And you told the story, and I thought it was really very striking. First of all, you told the story about how at one point you had been approached by the CIA to write a scenario for the capture of bin Laden. And then you went on to explain, well, you didn't take them up on the offer, but you did say, well, if I was going to do that, here's what I would say. I would say, if at all possible, you should try to take bin Laden alive. And then what you should do is you should go around the world and you should go to all those places where Al-Qaeda was responsible for violence, particularly places where Muslims had died, and put the guy on trial and put him on the stand and, you know, say, and what do you have to say about this, Mr. bin Laden, that your actions resulted in the death of these people? And your argument was that would really undercut his image and the image of Al-Qaeda around the world, and maybe for good or ill, well, that was not possible because of what happened when they found him. I guess I'm just wondering, what you now think about what did happen and what might have happened with bin Laden.
My idea was that, when the CIA approached me, is you can't just deal with the man. You have to deal with his legacy. And bin Laden, at that time, was the most famous man in the world, and he's going to be one of the most famous men in history. And so you have to somehow undo his legacy because it's very pernicious. And he provides a model for future groups that will someday come along that may not be acting in the name of Islam or any other religion, but have its own cause. So my suggestion was that, you know, that if we put him on trial in Kenya and Tanzania, where he killed 224 people, and many of them Muslims, and you could take him so many places, but you could end it with taking him back to Saudi Arabia, where hundreds of Muslims and non-Muslims have died at the hands of al-Qaeda, and put him on trial under Sharia, under Islamic law. I thought that would be a way of disarming that kind of legacy. Now, what I was told by the CIA, their anxiety was that if we captured him, that al-Qaeda would then proceed to capture Americans around the world and hold them for ransom as hostages for any kind of resolution of bin Laden, bin Laden's fate. And I sensed at that time that they were never intending to capture him. And indeed, it seems that, you know, they could have captured him had they wanted to. They didn't want to. They wanted to dispose of him as quickly as possible.
Well, and it seemed that what we learned about him was that in the years since 2001, that while he continued to be nominally the leader of the organization, and they had a way to try to get communications from him out, it looked like he was living a rather lonely and isolated existence, and one really has to ask the question, and perhaps it's the question about al-Qaeda, is that this spectacular event that got them worldwide attention, did it also really mean the death of al-Qaeda at the same time?
Well, al-Qaeda has been in decline for a long time. It's been decimated, it's isolated, but you know, the idea of al-Qaeda has taken root, and you know, the affiliates that we see around the world, you know, they still pose a real, especially in Yemen, and I see that as a future problem. But many of these other affiliates are basically nationalist organizations that ran up the al-Qaeda flag like a pirate flag because it got them more attention and respect, and maybe it got them a little money. Now that bin Laden is gone, it could be that they'll go back more to their nationalist pursuits. And the other thing, I think they've been chastised by seeing the results of the Arab Spring and how a popular revolution has such a much more profound effect than the violent one that they've been espousing. So this is a period of introspection for Islamism in general, I believe.
Mm. I think it's really, it's interesting, again, just trying to go back to the beginnings of al-Qaeda, and one of the things that you argue is that when coming out of the experience that he had in Afghanistan, when he had this group of fighters that did have some battle experience, although I think you also suggest that in terms of their contribution to the war against the Soviets, it was small to non-existent, but he had this revolutionary credential now. And that initially the idea that it wasn't that al-Qaeda was going to be a terrorist organization. It would be something that, and I think you used the kind of metaphor that it would be kind of like an Islamic foreign legion that would go around the world fighting against corrupt regimes. And, you know, the idea that it would mount the spectacular attack against the United States, at least initially, that was just not part of the program.
Right. He had a completely different agenda at that point. And, you know, it evolved its policies over a period of time. There were several real turning points. One was the invasion of Kuwait by Saddam Hussein, and then the massing of forces on the Saudi border in 1991 when bin Laden was back in Saudi Arabia. And you know, al-Qaeda was a small organization even then, you know, a couple hundred guys probably at the time. But he went to the Saudi defense minister and proposed that he would defend the kingdom with al-Qaeda and several hundred thousand unemployed Saudi youth in his father's construction machinery. Now, his father was a major contractor in Saudi Arabia, against what was a million-man army with one of the largest tank corps in the world. And, of course, he was laughed out of the office. It was an absurd idea. And but he knew that the Saudi forces could not defend themselves, and they would turn elsewhere for support. And inevitably, they did turn to the United States, which is exactly what he worried about. And he fell into disfavor with the royal family. And he had, under a subterfuge, he had to get his passport back, and he fled to Sudan and spent from 92 to 96 there. During that period of time, his goal was to get the non-Muslims, in other words, the American and coalition forces, out of the Holy Land, the Arabian Peninsula. But the other thing is, there was a famine going on in nearby Somalia, and American and other forces arrived to try to help distribute food there. And, of course, that's the Black Hawk Down era. But in the minds of al-Qaeda, they were being surrounded. That the Americans and other forces were after them. And, of course, the Americans didn't know who they were or what they were up to. And American intelligence, you know, al-Qaeda and bin Laden were not on our horizon. But in the paranoid imagination of bin Laden, they were. And then the State Department came up with the idea that it would be a good idea to demand that the Sudanese government expel Osama bin Laden because of his radical statements. And no doubt they'd been getting pressure from the Saudi authorities. So the Sudanese did that. And this was a time when we knew where bin Laden was. He was a businessman. He could be pretty much kept under control. But it was American policy to expel him from Sudan and just try to get rid of him as if he would go to another planet. Well, we were told, you know, he'll go back to Afghanistan. And, of course, that's what he did. The Sudanese authorities stole everything they could of bin Laden's property and his assets, so that when he left Sudan, he was a pauper, and he was angry. And when he arrived in Afghanistan shortly after that, he declared war on America. So there's a kind of cavalcade of events that have led to his decision to attack America, and some of those things have been our own mistaken actions.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Lawrence Wright. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. We're talking about his book, first published in 2006, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
This evening, it's an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's address before a joint session of Congress. Mr. Obama will talk about the economy and his jobs creation plan. Join Michelle Norris for in-depth coverage and analysis. That's an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's address before a joint session of Congress.
This evening at 6 on AM 580, FM 90.9, and online at will.illinois.edu.
Today's programs are made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign. For over 25 years, 10,000 Villages has provided income to artisans in more than 30 developing countries by marketing their handicrafts and telling their stories in North America.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings with 10 topics for you every week. Let me just mention that tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we will talk about the future of the U.S. space program with Lewis Friedman. He's an aeronautics engineer and is also executive director emeritus of the Planetary Society. Then also tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll have some more of what we're calling the Deep Archives. And what we're doing here to mark the fact that this year we've been on the air here with this program for 30 years, we have gone back to some of our past programs that have been in storage. They're not on our web archive. They're programs we think are interesting and sometimes rather controversial, and we try to organize them according to theme and present portions of a couple of interviews. This time around, we'll talk about the issue of physician-assisted death, and in part, we'll be airing an archive interview that I did back in the 90s with Dr. Jack Kevorkian, who just passed away this year. So that's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. You can get the schedule by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. Also, you can listen to past programs that way. In this hour of focus, our guest is Lawrence Wright. He's an author, screenwriter, playwright, staff writer for The New Yorker. He is the author of The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, won the Pulitzer Prize and many other awards, first published in 2006, is still available. You can read it. It's in a paperback edition published by Vintage. And we're talking about 9/11 and about Al-Qaeda. And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. You know, Mr. Wright, I want to maybe go back to the to this question about what the United States knew and when it knew it about Osama bin Laden. And so many people have made the point, I even made the point in introducing the show, that perhaps if the United States was paying attention to the signs, that the attack could have been avoided. At the same time, there would have been a point where, perhaps with some justification, people here in the United States would have looked at bin Laden and would have thought, well, this guy doesn't. He's got nothing. He can't attack the United States. What kind of resources does he have? There would have been a reason to kind of brush him off. So I mean, when does it get to the point where you could have said that and gotten away with it, and then you get into the territory of not being able to connect the dots and possibly preventing 9/11.
Well, you're right. I mean, it seemed comical when he declared war on America from a cave in Afghanistan. That, you know, who could take that seriously? And, you know, I think what we hadn't taken into account is that the world had changed, much more globalized than, you know, our isolation was no longer so effective from keeping us from foreign contests. People easily move in and out of borders now. So our whole way of life had changed, and we were sort of living in a idealized past. The notion that a small group could be so super empowered that it could change history is something that had not ever entered our consciousness until that time. There have been terrorists, and you know, certainly they've had an effect, but it had never had it on this kind of scale. So I can understand that American intelligence was not really paying attention or taking these threats very seriously until 1998, when these two bombs went off in front of American embassies in East Africa, and 224 people were killed. 150 people were blinded in Kenya by the flying glass. It was an appalling, devastating attack. But what's interesting about that is even then, Americans did not take the threat of terrorism very seriously. During the presidential campaign, it was rarely mentioned even as a subject. Yes, the intelligence community was rallied, but how did we respond to that? Well, President Clinton authorized some missiles, cruise missiles, to be sent to Khartoum, where we knew bin Laden was living, had been living, and to these training camps in Afghanistan. Well, we bombed a pharmaceutical plant, actually a veterinary pharmaceutical plant, that Al-Qaeda had nothing to do with, and killed the night watchman in Sudan. And then we bombed these mostly empty training camps in Afghanistan where bin Laden might have been had we been lucky, but we had no intelligence, and we were also not lucky. So, and that was our response. Then, in October of 2000, another attack, this one on the USS Cole in Yemen, in Aden, off the shore, getting fuel, refueled there. 17 American sailors are killed. Another direct attack on America's interest in that part of the world, very ingeniously done by a small boat laden with explosives. showing once again how a small group, suicidal and very determined, can make such an impact that they nearly sank a billion-dollar warship. Nothing was, you know, there was no response to that. There was, it was a sense of being in a trance almost, that there were, you know, there were elections underway. There was, we were involved in war already in the Muslim world. You know, what maybe we should just let this one pass. And it was, I think, a little infuriating to bin Laden and to al-Qaeda because they were trying to provoke America. They wanted us to come after them. His whole goal was to have America invade Afghanistan just as the Soviets had in 1979. Because in his mind, the paradigm was that the superpower enters Afghanistan, the graveyard of empires, spends 10 years, just like the Soviet Union, fighting against Muslims who've rallied to the cause, and then it withdraws, and what happens? It falls apart. It dissolves. And he really thought it was his policy to make the United States go into Afghanistan, and he thought that we would therefore become the dis-United States, and that would leave the way open for the last remaining superpower, Islam, to emerge and exert its power.
Hmm. We have a caller. Let's talk with them. Somebody in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. There was an interesting documentary about, what was the FBI agent, O'Neill?
John O'Neill.
Yeah, and you were talking about, I mean, there's a guy, and when you talk about politics in Yemen, he was certainly on the track there, but he was, you know, politics pretty much took care of that. You know, and you said, well, in terms of bin Laden, in some ways the goals have been accomplished, you know, in terms of what he's done. I mean, it's cost us lots of money, you know, and we're still there. Oh, any comment that you want to make? Maybe in terms of O'Neill, that's an interesting story there.
Yeah, John O'Neill is one of the heroes in my book. And, you know, after 9/11, I was in Austin, Texas. The planes were grounded. I was desperately trying to get to New York and find some way to write about this appalling tragedy, and I didn't know how to begin. So I started monitoring obituaries that were streaming online at the time. And a couple of days after 9/11, there was an obit on the Washington Post site for John O'Neill, who had been the head of counterterrorism in the New York office of the FBI. I knew from the fact that I had written a movie called The Siege about terrorism that might happen in New York that Denzel Washington and Bruce Willis starred in. I had talked to some people in that FBI office, and I knew that they had that the FBI office had the authority, the warrant on bin Laden. They were in charge of the investigation, and O'Neill was in charge of that unit. So I put two and two together, and I realized that the man that was supposed to get bin Laden didn't get bin Laden. Bin Laden got him. And I thought at the time, what a terrible irony. But as I began to investigate, I realized it was more of a Greek tragedy because O'Neill, who was forced to leave the Bureau because he had mistakenly taken some classified information out of the office, he became head of security at the World Trade Center. And that seemed like another ironic twist of fate. But he told friends he deliberately went there because al-Qaeda had struck at the World Trade Center before, and they wouldn't stop until they finished the job. So he instinctively placed himself on the altar of Ground Zero. And I now no longer see that as ironic at all, but as an act of human sacrifice on his part.
Mm. Well, again, questions are welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest in this hour is Lawrence Wright. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and is author of the book The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. Won the Pulitzer Prize, is in paperback now, published by Vintage. Something, just a kind of a side thing in a way, maybe, that I want to ask you to talk about, and just because it has been such a commonplace, and when I was going back and looking over the book, this kind of jumped out at me, and that is that that while the United States did indeed support the freedom fighters in Afghanistan who were trying to drive out the Soviets, that what you report in the book is that the Arab fighters that bin Laden was there involved with in Afghanistan didn't get any support from the United States. So this commonplace that we hear that, well, because the United States supported them in Afghanistan, that in fact we created bin Laden and al-Qaeda, that's actually not true.
No, it's not. It's just a myth that's been perpetuated forever, and I don't know if we'll ever be able to extinguish it. But here's what did happen. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia made a deal that they would support the Mujahideen, the largely Afghan fighters in Afghanistan in their war against the Soviet Union. And so dollar for dollar, we sent money that went into the hands of the Pakistani Intelligence Service, the ISI, which was the disperser for a lot of that money. Now, they raked off a lot of that dough, by the way, to build up their nuclear arsenal. And but at the same time, they were the disperser for the money that went to seven different warlords in Afghanistan. In the CIA, they were known as the Seven Dwarfs. Some of those warlords, in particular, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, were precursors of the Taliban. So in some ways, you might say that, you know, the money that we gave to prop up the warlords in their war against the Soviet Union did become seed money for the Taliban, but really it was the ISI that directly created the Taliban. The Americans didn't know very much about the Arab fighters. They were a ragtag crew. They did get money privately from Saudi sources. Bin Laden was a Saudi. He had a lot of friends. He had connections to the royal family. No doubt he did raise a lot of money privately. And it could be that the ISI gave him some money on the side, although I've never seen that. But directly having America fund al-Qaeda and create it? No. Moreover, al-Qaeda wasn't created until 1988. The jihad against the Soviets was essentially over. They'd already announced that they were withdrawing. And in fact, that was the reason that al-Qaeda was created, because there was a now-what quality. We've created this group of jihadis, and we ought to put them to use. And that's when, as you mentioned earlier, bin Laden got the idea of taking some of these Arab fighters and creating a kind of Muslim militia that could be used and deployed elsewhere in the world.
Mm. I think we're having another caller here. We'll get in. We have just, again, about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus. The caller here is in Champaign County, here where we are. It's line number one. We'll go there. Hello. The caller there, line one, Champaign County?
Yeah. It was a joint project is what it was, and ISI was dealing money, and Gobet and Hekmatyar, who were now fighting again, though we made an overture to him, you know, got $8 billion. It was still the idea that, and it's a commonality of U.S. foreign policy, that we prefer fundamentalists to radical nationalists, and that's true in Saudi Arabia. It's true when Israel started funding Hamas because they preferred to balance them with the Fatah. It's a blowback policy that's faded. I mean, the fact that the CIA didn't directly give money to, he was well enough off, as you say, he had his own Saudi, but we were coordinating with the Saudis in the funding of that. We coordinated with the Saudis when they were funding the Pakistani bomb. So, it's not so easy to dismiss it as a, you know, the fact that it wasn't direct doesn't mean that it wasn't a blowback phenomenon.
No, Mr. Wright.
I can understand. You know, I agree that we did create a blowback inadvertently. We weren't directly funding Al Qaeda, but the blowback is, multifarious. There's many different prongs of it. There is, first of all, the creation of the Taliban. That was, it's a direct result of our involvement with the ISI. And then there is the blowback of the creation of the Taliban, of the Pakistani nuclear weapon, which, probably couldn't have been accomplished without the money that we were pouring into Pakistan at the time through the hands of the army and the intelligence. The Al Qaeda is just a small part of that, really. I mean, it's still a relatively small terrorist organization that has made a profound effect on us. But in the larger scheme of things, it's not nearly as massive as the Taliban, and it doesn't compare in scope to the consequences of the nuclear contest that we now have between Pakistan and India. So there are many different ways that we can say that this is blown back in our faces.
Well, still, the point is that we prefer fundamentalists to radical nationalists because it's manipulable, but it is a blowback. And, our foreign policy is just riven with this kind of thing. There are more people killed in the U.S.-sponsored coup in Haiti, and the population is much smaller than were killed in 9/11. I mean, the Chilean coup at the same date, 73 years earlier, in 1973, these are chickens coming home to roost, and I'm always called to blame America first, but we have to take responsibility for the policy that puts oil, the oil prize, above everything. And thank you.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
We have about 5 minutes left. Again, if we can get back to specifically to 9/11, one of the things you explain in the book, you chart how it is that the idea ultimately developed, and it did take some time from the beginning, where the idea, and apparently this was something that had been proposed by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was an important in the leadership of Al-Qaeda and now is being held at Guantanamo. He apparently just had this idea that he was going to hijack some planes and kill a lot of the people who were on board. How did they get from that to this idea of taking the planes and flying them into buildings?
There have been several different suggestions about where that idea originally came from. And I think... in my opinion, it was the man who is now the security director for Al-Qaeda. His name is Saif al-Adl. He was an Egyptian military officer, and one of my sources in Cairo knew him pretty well. And he told me that Saif al-Adl had come to him with a plan to hijack an airplane and fly it into the Egyptian parliament. This is long, long before 9/11. But, that idea was in his mind, and he became a very important figure in the Shura Council of Al-Qaeda and had the ear of bin Laden and Zawahiri. He was one of Zawahiri's men. So that's my thinking about where that came from. There are other sources for that, but, I think that if, you have a man sitting on the Shura Council who's already thought it up, and if you have Ramzi Yousef's uncle come in and give you this idea of hijacking an airplane, it's easy to imagine how to marry that to Saif al-Adl's notion.
Hmm. And again, we talked about, I mentioned how chance perhaps plays a role here, at least until the men who ended up being the leaders of the hijackers showed up. They really, there was no way for them, there would not have been any way for them to carry this scheme out.
They were incredibly fortunate in the, this little group that arrived from Hamburg who really wanted to be deployed in Chechnya or Bosnia, and they didn't have any interest in, at the time, of becoming suicide bombers in the United States, but they happened to be perfect candidates. They spoke English. They were technocrats. Al-Qaeda had the plan for 9/11, and they just didn't have people who could actually carry it out. And here come this, you know, this little band of guys who are, you know, a gift from heaven as far as bin Laden is concerned. And within a few weeks of their arrival, they have been directed into their mission. And it happens that they have some guys who are very skilled, very directed, and willing to give up their lives.
Just real quick here, we have about a minute. Because of 9/11, the place of Osama bin Laden's place in history is assured. Around the world, though, particularly in the Muslim world, is he still considered to be a hero?
Well, yes, in many places. There's a lot of mourning for his absence, and, you know, yet I think this Arab Spring, the coincidence of his death and this tumultuous change in the Arab world, I think has really made a paradigm shift in the mentality of many Muslims. And I think it's terrific. I think it's, you know, very, very helpful that the concept of nonviolent social change led by people with many, and with a diverse number of backgrounds, but mainly young people who are looking to Western models and wanting to be a part of the world. This is the change in the Arab world. Al-Qaeda is not going to make the change. And I think that that's been made evident to people all over the Muslim world.
We will have to leave it at that. Our guest is Lawrence Wright. He's author, screenwriter, playwright, staff writer for The New Yorker, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. It's available now in paperback. It's published by Vintage Books, if you'd like to read it. And Mr. Wright, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure, David. Thank you.
Around the world, though, particularly in the Muslim world, is he still considered to be a hero?
Well, yes, in many places. There's a lot of mourning for his absence, and, you know, yet I think this Arab Spring, the coincidence of his death and this tumultuous change in the Arab world, I think has really made a paradigm shift in the mentality of many Muslims. And I think it's terrific. I think it's, you know, very, very helpful that the concept of nonviolent social change led by people with many, and with a diverse number of backgrounds, but mainly young people who are looking to Western models and wanting to be a part of the world. This is the change in the Arab world. Al-Qaeda is not going to make the change. And I think that that's been made evident to people all over the Muslim world.
We will have to leave it at that. Our guest is Lawrence Wright. He's author, screenwriter, playwright, staff writer for The New Yorker, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. It's available now in paperback. It's published by Vintage Books, if you'd like to read it. And Mr. Wright, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure, David. Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from AAA Storage in Urbana and Champaign, offering both climate-controlled and regular storage in all sizes with facility managers on site. AAA Storage, 1710 North Cunningham, Urbana, and 2202 North Market in Champaign.
We will take a break, as we do at this point, in midway through. We'll have an update for you on the markets and some news from National Public Radio. When we come back, we'll have a health topic for you. Our guest in hour two will be Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist, so we'll take questions about GI problems. First, though, an update on the markets.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session, heading into the end of the week, and in anticipation of next Monday's USDA crop production and WASDE reports, The market has a definite softer tone today, with all of the grains showing decreases in futures. Meanwhile, over in the livestock market, prices are a little bit firmer today. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. In Kansas City, September wheat at 835, down 7. December, 848 and a quarter, down 10 and 3 quarters. March of next year, 861, down 9 and 3 quarters. September wheat at the Board of Trade at 705 and a half, down 9 and a quarter. December, 740, down 11 and a half. March, 777, down 12. September corn, 725 and 3 quarters, down 10 and 3 quarters. December, 736, down 12. March, 748 and 3 quarters, down 12. May, 755 and 3 quarters, down 12. July, 760 and a half, down.